Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we examine recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world and see how these events affect global stability and U.S. national security. In the latter part of the program, we're going to focus on Japan, its military history, its current capabilities, and its importance to the United States as an ally. But Marshawn, I'd like to start with this interesting story which appeared recently. An investigation by The Intercept and 100 Reporters has revealed details of a vast, shadowy network of U.S. programs to train annually about 200,000 foreign soldiers, police, and other personnel all over the world. The report is based on thousands of WikiLeaks released secret cables. The cables were amongst those provided by Private Chelsea Manning, who is now serving a 35-year sentence in a military prison. Although most Americans are unaware of these U.S. training programs, the cables reveal that they take place at least 471 locations in 120 countries and involve, on the U.S. side, 150 different defense and civilian agencies, armed forces colleges, and even National Guard units. The Department of Defense alone has poured some $122 billion into such programs since 9/11. Marshawn, what do you think of the usefulness of this program?
As a military strategy, it has been proven to be fairly ineffective. I mean, if there's anything we've learned from the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, the training of the Afghan National Army, the Afghan National Police in particular, we can see that this sort of short-term idea that, well, we're going to train a few hundred Afghan police officers, we're going to train a few hundred Afghan soldiers for a couple of weeks, send them through a basic training type deal, and that's it, and we're done, and, you know, well done to everyone. As we can see from Iraq, that was not an effective strategy, and that's why the Iraqi army collapsed, and indeed that's why the Afghan army is collapsing all around Helmand in the south of Afghanistan. As a military strategy, we can see that this is not effective. As a political strategy, a means of exporting American influence, it is also not effective. Because again, you are not providing adequate technical training as well as adequate indoctrination. And I'll give you the best example. The best example is if you travel to any former British colony, whether it's India or Kenya or South Africa, or you go to pretty much almost any former British colony, one of the things you will see consistently is the police force is modeled off of the British police force, the London Metropolitan. You look at the army is modeled off of the British Army, the Air Force off of the Royal Air Force, et cetera, et cetera. Because when the British arrived in these colonies, they arrived to stay, and they left an indelible mark. They mentored. They didn't just train. They didn't just send the Kenyan officer corps through basic training and then said, well, have good luck. They actually mentored them all the way through the process when they began to leave, when they knew, okay, we're handing over power to the locals. They mentored these future officers up until the point where they handed the nation over to them. And so this left a much more indelible mark on the country. You can send over a few special forces, a few National Guardsmen, a few reservists, and train the Ukrainian army for 6 weeks, but it's not going to provide them what is fundamentally adequate technically for people who lack any firearms experience or any real military experience or military organization. It's not going to be adequate when you're dealing with an officer corps in the local army that's largely corrupt. It's not going to be adequate when there is no indoctrination. As much as we hate that word indoctrination, the fact is that ideological training is as important as military training. If you just hand guns to a bunch of militiamen, as we did in Afghanistan, what happens is you end up with warlords running the Afghan army. The only difference is instead of warlords with a private army, they're now all generals in the Afghan National Army, but the Afghan National Army is still their private army.
And Marshawn, one of the notable failures in foreign training programs was a $500 million Pentagon effort to train and equip the U.S.-backed Syrian rebels. And it was supposed to produce 15,000 fighters over 3 years, and it yielded just a few dozen before the program was finally scrapped.
Problem is we're trying to get the benefits of a permanent occupation on the cheap is in essence what we're going for. And realistically speaking, if you really want to leave that indelible mark, you have to accept that we are going to be in this country for the next 30, 40 years. We're going to reform their system, in essence, a form of modern colonialism. But that really, as much as we hate the word colonialism, the fact is modern colonialism is the only way you're actually going to leave a beneficial mark. Because this whole notion that we're going to go into a country, we're going to hand some guns to some so-called Mujahideen holy warriors, and the country is going to be reformed, is lunatic. It has never worked. It is it is a harebrained idea.
And let me suggest that if we're going to go down the route of colonialism, we shouldn't be doing this on the down and low. We should be engaging the American people in a frank discussion about whether they want this kind of extensive overseas operations. I don't think that they're aware of it, and I don't think if they were aware of it, they would necessarily approve of it. Marchand, I'd like to move on to Afghanistan, which you were just talking about, because President Obama says that 8,400 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan at the end of 2016. Of course, he'd hoped to have them all out. And during his first term, President Obama greatly escalated U.S. troop deployment to Afghanistan. Are the survival prospects of the U.S.-backed Afghan government now any better than they were before?
Absolutely not. I mean, Afghanistan is also a unique case, too, because you have to remember, and I've had the pleasure to meet very many Afghans, and one of the things that's very striking is that unlike Iraq, which for all intents and purposes was a modern country and still is to a great extent, I mean, most people have television sets, most people have radios, most people know what's going on in the world. In Afghanistan, you have a few major cities. You have, you know, Herat, Mazar Sharif, Kabul, but then you have thousands upon thousands of villages where majority of the population live with no access to radios, no access to television sets, completely disconnected from the rest of the world and completely disconnected from each other. You can be born in one valley and never meet the people in the village in the next valley. And at the same time, that makes it a very difficult country to occupy because this country doesn't have a network. You can't really tie everything into a central government. It makes it much more difficult, let alone trying to separate the populace from the Taliban, because in order to provide security in all these thousands and thousands of tiny little villages, you have to have a million men. Even then, it's going to be incredibly challenging, as we could see from the Soviets, who fought a very brutal campaign in Afghanistan, and they had a very hard time wresting the country from the Mujahideen. It's just, it's not a country that lends itself to easy occupation. It was, in fact, actually General Roberts, who led the British forces in the Second Anglo-Afghan War, he famously said to the Afghans, the less they see of us, the less they'll dislike us. And that is a very true statement. So keeping 8,400 troops there is not going to increase the survivability of the Kabul government. The only thing that might would be sending a million men into the country. And even then, it's not a country that lends itself very well to occupation.
Now, Marchand, I'd like to turn to Iraq. We've been in Afghanistan for 15 years. We've been in Iraq for 13 years. President Obama is sending an additional 560 U.S. troops to Iraq, which will bring the total number of U.S. troops there to over 5,000. While they are technically advisors, the U.S. troops are close to the fighting and continue to be wounded and killed. Do these U.S. troops make a significant difference in the equation? Will they contribute significantly to the possible recapture of Mosul, that very key city, oil-rich city in the northern part of Iraq, which is currently held by the Islamic State?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that our troops are helping. I mean, much in the same way that in Afghanistan, our troops are the only thing keeping the Kabul government in power, much the same way our troops are being of some assistance. The problem is that it is, much like in Afghanistan, it is a half-hearted effort. In essence, what this administration is hoping to achieve is throwing the failure on the next guy. Because at least that's what it appears to be as an analyst, is that the administration is hoping to just push it on to the next administration. President Obama and his administration do not want to be the ones held responsible for losing Afghanistan, losing Iraq. They claimed that they would be out of the country, that Iraq and Afghanistan would be self-sustaining. That's not the case. They just do not want the governments to fall. You want to look at a successful intervention, you don't really have to look any further than the Russian intervention in Syria. The Russians have pushed back ISIS on every front. It has been methodical, but you have to remember that it has been Russian troops that have been the spearhead of the fighting, and they've lost some of their young men in that fight, but they have been the spearhead. alongside the Syrian army, which was always much more capable than the Iraqi army, but even then, Russian technical experts, Russian special forces, SOBR counterterrorism units have been essential in pushing ISIS back. Whereas on the other hand, in Iraq, 500 soldiers is a great idea, but without troops on the ground to coordinate the airstrikes, without troops on the ground to coordinate directly with the Iraqi battalions in the field and the Iraqi companies in the field, it's much more of a half-hearted effort. It's going to take a lot longer. It's going to result in a lot more deaths. And very frankly, it will more likely than not result in the Russians pushing ISIS completely into Iraq and then leaving the United States holding the bag.
Marshawn, speaking of Syria, the action there seems to be now in the neighborhood of Aleppo, where the Syrian army is besieging the Islamic State forces. And there's also a lot of action in suburban Damascus against the strongholds of the Islamic State. And many residents have fled these areas, and those remaining live in harsh conditions and are subject to regular bombardment. As you noted, the Russians have assisted the Syrians. The Iranians are assisting the Syrians, and the Syrian government seems to be steadily gaining ground against the rebels. Secretary of State Kerry said that Assad must start transition from power by the 1st of August. That date, of course, is approaching very quickly. I don't think that's going to happen. Where does that leave the United States strategy in Syria? And where does it leave its relationship with Russia?
We have to get with the times. Assad is here to stay. He is. The Russian army is there to back him. It is not just Assad and the Syrian army, but it is Assad supported by thousands of Russian soldiers, Russian bombers and helicopters, supported by thousands of Iranian Revolutionary Guard and Hezbollah. They are going to be taking more ground. They're going to be pushing out ISIS out of around Damascus, this Free Syrian Army out from around Damascus, ISIS out of Aleppo. In addition to that, they're starting to cut off ISIS access to Raqqa, the ISIS capital.
To his credit, Marshawn, Secretary of State Kerry has resisted calls for a no-fly zone, and that call was also made by a Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton. Kerry also met with the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, in France on July the 15th to discuss Syria. It may be that Kerry is starting to get a little reality check.
None of the characters that we have been backing in this revolution are nice guys, let's face it. In fact, an organization that the United States was backing just beheaded a child. And that was reported in the Associated Press on July 20th. So these aren't nice guys, but the fact is that cutting up spheres of influence in the Middle East is going to be far more beneficial to us. It's the doctrine of Harry Truman. The way Harry Truman established peace with the Soviet Union was carving up Europe and the Far East. And that is the exact same thing we need to do with Russia now. Because let Russia handle ISIS in Syria. Let them have Assad. That's fine. They can have Syria. They can have influence in Lebanon. We, on the other hand, will accept influence in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states. That is the way you create stability. On the other hand, this rhetoric of toppling Assad, it's not realistic. It really is not.
In addition, Marshawn, I would think that a rapprochement with Iran would also enhance stability and ultimately U.S. national security in that region.
Iran is the proxy of Russia. Iran is only going to be so bold as Russia lets them. And that's one of the things we tend to forget. We antagonize the Russians, and then we say, well, if we open up relations with Iran, that'll improve the situation. What'll improve the situation with Iran, realistically, is improving relations with Russia. Because Iran gets all its weapons from Russia, gets all its training from Russia, all of its hardware from Russia. The Iranian economy is supported by the Russian economy right now.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and we've been talking about the war in the Mideast, in particular the situations in Iraq and in Syria. Marshawn, of course, we talk about strategy, we talk about tactics, we talk about military hardware and history in this show, but I think we need to mention, too, the human cost of war. And one of the most egregious examples is the siege of Fallujah in 2004. And I just want to mention that a medical report came out a few years ago from the United Kingdom that found the following, that leukemia in Fallujah increased eightfold following the attack. Cancers in children increased 12-fold. and the doctors observed grotesque birth deformities, including a girl born with two heads. The UK report stated that the increase in cancer and other serious health problems exceeded those reported by victims of the U.S. atom bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And one of the UK physicians who conducted the research said that the extent of genetic damage suffered by the inhabitants of Fallujah suggested the use of uranium in some form in the U.S. ordnance fired on Fallujah. So just as we're very sensitive in this show to the effect on U.S. national security of our foreign policy, of our military policy, we should also be sensitive to the impact that these policies have on innocent people who are caught in the middle of war.
There have been a lot of Iraqis and a lot of Americans, let's not forget all of our American soldiers, who've also paid the price in this conflict.
As you say, the American soldiers have been killed and horribly maimed, and many suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. The suicide rate of U.S. veterans has increased sharply since 2001. So this price is being paid all around, and it behooves the citizens of this country to pay close and critical attention to the foreign military policy of our government. Now, Marchand, I would like to turn to Europe. NATO is sending 4 battalions to Eastern Europe to counter what it deems Russia's, quote, aggressive leadership, unquote. And it's interesting, the New York Times article on this new deployment of battalions to Eastern Europe refers to Russia as, quote, increasingly pugnacious, unquote. And a Western official also referred to the countries on Russia's western flank as, quote, the Eastern Front, a term eerily reminiscent of World War II, where it was used to refer to the German front against the Soviet Union. A, are these battalions going to make any difference? And B, is the United States getting dangerously close to a war in Eastern Europe with Russia?
Well, it is interesting. There was an article in Newsweek, the week of the, I believe it was July 19th, that discussed the attitudes in Russia, which are that war is becoming inevitable. In fact, one of the things that was interesting that the article cited was that Russians are starting to hoard food now. And the journalist had actually gone and talked to people on the street. And, you know, ordinary taxi drivers were saying, well, when are we going to war? War is coming. You know, it's, we're almost on the verge of war with NATO. Everybody's stocking up on buckwheat, which is a staple of the Russian diet. And so it's pushing ourselves towards almost inevitable conflict. Realistically speaking, a handful of battalions are not going to make the difference, especially given how small our military is right now. I refer, of course, to the comments of General Mike Milley, the chief of staff of the Army, when he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he said that right now the United States is incapable militarily of fighting a superpower struggle. When asked to define what he felt a superpower struggle was, he said a war with Iran, North Korea, China, or, and I emphasize, or Russia, meaning we cannot fight any of these countries individually because we have shrunk our military to such a tiny extent. I have heard a lot of people argue that, well, in the event of war with Russia, we'll do like we did in World War II and call up a lot of conscripts. Back during World War II, you could train a pilot in a week. You can't do that now. Back during World War II, you could train somebody to operate a tank in a week. Our military hardware is much more complex. It would take a lot longer to mobilize a large enough force. And by that time, a couple battalions will be overrun, and the Russians will have 100,000 troops in Warsaw. If we consider that this war is coming, if we are really genuinely trying to prepare for a war with Russia, we need to ramp up our military capabilities. We also need to consider the fact that the Chinese are not just going to sit on the sidelines. The Chinese have been conducting joint operations with the Russians for the last decade. So it is entirely possible that China will take the opportunity to grab some turf of its own.
How is it necessary to U.S. national security that the Baltic states and the Ukraine, countries that were once part of the Soviet Union, be incorporated into NATO, an anti-Russian Western military alliance?
The Baltic states are already members of NATO, so whether we like it or not, that bridge has been crossed, but the Ukraine is not. And in fact, one of the ways we've kept stability with the Russians has been that we respected their influence in Belarus, we respected their influence in Ukraine, and we respected their influence in Georgia. NATO is NATO. Let's not add any more countries to it. The countries that are in NATO are already in NATO. We've crossed that bridge. But what's not essential to U.S. national security is the fact that we are trying to provoke the Russians in Ukraine by bringing Ukraine into NATO. And let's also not forget, the folks that we're backing in Ukraine aren't exactly nice guys. We are backing an entity that is, in many ways, pro-Nazi. I mean, they have the Stefan Bandera Battalion, who was a Nazi collaborator. They have the Azov Battalion, which uses Nazi symbols. And many of its leaders have described themselves openly as National Socialists.
And they've also worked in an alliance with Chechen Islamic radicals.
That's another point, yes. A lot of Chechen Islamist fundamentalists, people connected to Al-Qaeda, have been coming in to Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainian government. So not only is this antagonizing Russia, but it is also detrimental to our security, because let's not forget the last time we backed Islamists, we ended up with Osama bin Laden. Obviously, we didn't learn that lesson from 9/11, and obviously we haven't learned that lesson from our experience in Syria. But to make the same mistake three or four times, I believe would be the definition of insanity.
Marshawn, I can see why the Russians, having lost 20 million people in an invasion from the West in World War II, see the nations like Ukraine on their border. In fact, Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union, as essential to their national security. The way we would say a secure Mexico and Canada be as essential to ours. But I don't see how the Ukraine is any way essential to the defense of the United States. It seems to me that we've been going down the wrong road for years, really since the end of the Cold War, confronting and surrounding the Russians, when in fact we could be reaching accommodation with them and enhancing world peace and enhancing our national security.
Under the Bush administration, we actually had some of the best relations with Russia that we've had in a very long time, because President Bush had an understanding with Vladimir Putin. We will not push into your sphere of influence. You will not push into ours. When we went to Afghanistan, the Russians cooperated with us. When we knew that Al-Qaeda terrorists were hiding out in the Caucasus, the Russians supported us. The Russians proved themselves that they were willing to support us so long as we'd agree to leave their sphere of influence alone. And we have to remember why the Russian sphere of influence is so important to them. Russia's been invaded more times than most countries on the planet have invaded, and they've been invaded longer than most countries on the planet have existed. So for the Russians, the paranoia of being invaded is historical. Keeping that buffer zone was always a way of keeping their enemies at bay. In fact, Stalin, who was, for all intents and purposes, he was a Georgian, but the reason why he seized so much of Western Europe was he said that never again would the West threaten Russia.
And here we have our NATO fleet in large force conducting a war exercise in the Baltic Sea, very near Russia, right off really Kaliningrad, which is a Russian city in the Baltic. How would we feel if the Russian fleet were conducting war exercises in the Gulf of Mexico? We wouldn't be too happy about it. And yet we seem to think the Russians are unreasonable to be upset.
These former countries weren't just part of the Soviet Union. We tend to treat countries like Ukraine as, you know, this country had been independent and very happy until the Soviet Union showed up. No, it was part of Tsarist Russia prior to then.
One of the consequences of our anti-Russian policy has been to drive Russia into the arms of China, which is not its natural ally. Russia has become a leading supplier of high-tech weaponry and resources such as oil and gas to Russia, while China is a major source of capital investments for projects in Russia. So China is now being enhanced by a Russian alliance, and China poses much more of a threat to U.S. interests in the Pacific. And relevant to that, the International Court recently denied China's claim to control of the South China Sea. There was a ruling in favor of the chief challenger to China's hegemony in the South China Sea, the Philippines, and the court ruled that China's claim for control over the South China Sea was not supported by international law, and that China's artificial islands, and remember they've been erecting artificial islands on these uninhabited reefs in the South China Sea, these new artificial islands do not give rise to a territorial waters claim since the islands were not inhabited. Does China care about what the international court said? Will this affect in any way its expansion into the South China Sea?
Absolutely not. Fundamentally, the International Criminal Court can make whatever rulings it wants. The Hague can make whatever rulings it wants. But at the end of the day, it has no means to enforce the rulings. If the United States, NATO, if our allies were to try to sail a fleet through there and evict the Chinese, that might have an impact, albeit that would probably lead to war. But the fact is the Chinese know there is no way for us to, or for the international court, to enforce its ruling, because China has the world's largest military. And while it may be untested in battle, does any nation really want to risk war with China? Because countries like the Philippines have been leaning very heavily on the United States for protection from countries like China. But at the end of the day, also, China knows how vulnerable we are militarily. They know how we've defunded our military. And they look at the Europeans. The Europeans are only now starting to rearm in the face of a Russian threat. So China's going to continue to push, continue to expand until it is fundamentally challenged. And even then, if it is fundamentally challenged by a United States that has hollowed out its armed forces, the Chinese might not be entirely afraid of a direct confrontation.
Well, there was some talk of a pivot to the Pacific, and it seems to me that makes sense, because we should not be creating unnecessarily confrontation with Russia, with whom we can reach an understanding. But on the other hand, China, I see as a really a much more difficult situation, because they want the South China Sea. I don't see any way they're going to compromise on that. And once they get control of that, we're very vulnerable in other places in the Pacific. I think that's an area that we really need to focus on. And of course, we'll be following it closely. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking most recently about the confrontation between the United States and Russia in Eastern Europe, and about Chinese expansionism in the South China Sea and how it may pose a national security problem for the United States. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to one. You can download this or prior editions of the War Report to your computer or mobile device from our website, incontextreport.com, or from SoundCloud under WPKN Community Radio, or just go to WPKN.org and click on podcast. You can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. In today's show, we're also going to focus on Japan, its military history, its current capabilities, and its geopolitical importance to U.S. foreign policy interests in the Pacific. Marshawn, how important is the U.S. alliance with Japan?
The U.S. alliance with Japan is, one could say, even more important than the alliance with South Korea. I mean, if you look at the alliance with South Korea is essential economically and for security in the Korean Peninsula, but Japan, being twice the size of Korea, is really, militarily speaking, an important alliance because it's a buffer against China, but also more to the point, it is really our only buffer against China, because between Japan and the United States lie a handful of islands such as Wake Island, Guam, and Hawaii. So Japan really is an essential ally militarily because it provides that buffer against China, a buffer against North Korea, and we could even say a buffer against Russia in the Pacific.
Does Japan have the strongest military in Asia apart from China?
At one time, Japan did rule the roost in the Pacific militarily, but since the end of World War II, Japan was forced into a pacifist constitution, which forced Japan to have a self-defense force used for defensive purposes only. Offensive military capabilities and even its defensive military capabilities were greatly limited. The major assumption was that in the event of war, the United States would defend Japan. Now what we're beginning to see, though, is a modernization of Japan's military, a rearming of Japan, a refurbishing of their military capabilities. And one of the things that's always very difficult to tell with Japan is it's a very insular society. So often things like military expansion is done in secret. We can only guess what really goes on, because after all, the Japanese constructed the Yamato and the Musashi, which were the two largest battleships in the world next to the Bismarck before World War II. And those were constructed in violation of the League of Nations treaty, which said Japan could only have a limited navy given its size. And they felt it was unfair because the European powers and the Americans, who held much more territory, could have much larger navies. But they were able to construct these ships in secret without the knowledge of the West. But it is clear now Japan is building its military. It is rearming. It does have a nationalist prime minister and is ruled by, one can say, for all intents and purposes, an ultra-nationalist party.
Is the United States obligated to come to Japan's aid in the event that Japan is attacked?
Yes, that was one of our arguments for limiting the size of the Japanese military. We are by treaty pledged to mutual defense. In the event Japan is attacked, we are obligated to come to Japan's defense. Much the same way also in the Japanese Constitution, they are obligated to come to our defense or come to the defense of their allies, a clause called mutual defense.
Now, Marchand, there is, of course, a strong military culture in Japan, and a lot of it has to do with the samurai. Who were the samurai?
The samurai were Japan's warrior class, and that's a tradition that dates back over 1,000 years. Actually, one could say probably almost 2,000 years. It's almost as ancient as Japan itself. The word samurai means to serve. It means one who serves. A samurai was a warrior who dedicated his whole life to the art of warfare. Best analogy would be akin to our knights in Western Europe. And up until the 16th century, anybody could become a samurai. In the 16th into the 17th century, those eventually changed to limit the potential for the peasantry to rise up socially. You had to be born into the samurai class at that point. The idea of the samurai continued to prevail. And then after the Meiji Restoration in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, when Japan modernized, they restored the idea of the universal samurai, the idea that every soldier, whether a private or an officer in the army, private or general in the army, could be a samurai or was a samurai. The samurai spirit is something that lives inside every Japanese person, ultimately, whether they work in finance or whether they work in industry or whether they work in the military or law enforcement. I would recommend to our listeners that they read Bushido, which means the way of the warrior. And there's some very good translations out there, but that embodies the samurai spirit, which is essential to the Japanese soul.
And what are some of the qualities of the Bushido code?
Well, honor being the highest. The samurai was expected to commit suicide if his honor was damaged, was tarnished. If it appeared that he ran away in battle, if he lost a battle, he was expected to commit suicide. If it appeared even that he had betrayed his lord or that he had failed his lord in some way, he was expected to commit suicide. And that's one of the reasons why to this day Japan has the highest suicide rate per capita of any country in the world.
Was there a spiritual aspect to the Bushido code?
In a lot of ways, yes. They believe that death was part of being the warrior. There's a Japanese saying, which is, life is like the cherry blossom, beautiful but brief. You are expected to die in battle. It is your greatest honor. So their whole warrior ethos centers around the idea that I'm going to die and I'm going to go join my ancestors. Or if you're a Buddhist, you are going to be reborn.
I had thought that the samurai class was actually a small elite, so I was surprised to read that at the end of the 19th century, a census counted almost 1.3 million members of the high samurai. These are ones allowed to ride a horse, and about 500,000 members of the low samurai who were allowed to wear two swords but not ride a horse. This was in a country of only 25 million. So it was a very, very large group of elite warriors.
Absolutely. Really, they were the backbone of the daimyo, of the warlord. The idea was that you would call up your peasant army and they would be the foot soldiers, but your samurai were your professional soldiers. They were the ones who would train your peasant soldiers. They were the ones who, in the time of the Japanese Civil War, the Sengoku Jidai, which is the age of the country at war, when all the warlords were vying for power, what it boiled down to was who could train the best army. And that was also back when you could raise peasants up to be samurai. Again, the idea being that these are your professional soldiers who are going to train the next generation, who are going to train the peasants to become warriors.
Following the Meiji Restoration, which occurred after U.S. Commodore Matthew Perry opened Japan in 1854, the Japanese are very pragmatic people, embraced Western technology, both military and civilian. So they've developed rather rapidly a Western style, Western technology army. Has that military tradition of the samurai somehow melded with this Western military technology?
We did to the Japanese what we didn't do to any other belligerent in World War II. We pledged them, you will be pacifist and that's it. Your military can only come to the aid of others, only in defense and only in support roles. The current Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, belongs to a society of ultra-nationalists called the Nippon Kaigi. It's an ultra-nationalist society that advocates the revocation of the Japanese Constitution, which pledges them to pacifism. It advocates for a restoration of Japan's military to its traditional level, but also it advocates for the raising up of Shintoism, which is the state religion, the returning of the emperor to the role as the divine emperor. in Japan's state religion, which is Shintoism, the emperor is a living god, as opposed to the idea that the emperor is divinely ordained, such as in Great Britain, the queen is chosen by God, but the queen is not God. In Japan, the emperor is God. This role has been diminished since the end of World War II, but entities like the Nippon Kaigi want to restore that. And it's exceptionally powerful because this is a society that the Prime Minister of Japan belongs to. And it's no coincidence that in January of 2016, the Japanese Parliament passed a bill which reinterpreted Japan's constitution, one can say. The idea of mutual defense is in the constitution. So what they said is that this means that we can come to the defense of any of our allies. So if the United States is attacked, we can come to their defense. Well, there's nothing there that says we can't come to their defense in offensive operations. It just says that Japan can't wage a war of aggression. This, for the first time since the end of World War II, allows the Japanese army to engage in offensive war as opposed to just defensive war.
Of course, a likely opponent in such an offensive war would be China. Japan has a longstanding antagonism with China. It goes back many centuries. Marshawn, could you talk about the attempted invasions of Japan by China back in the 1200s?
In the 1200s, it was logical that China would invade Japan just because the Mongols had conquered China and they were expanding west, and logically they would expand east, and Japan was already in a Chinese cultural sphere. They'd inherited their religion from China, Zen Buddhism. They'd also inherited their writing system and many cultural aspects from China. So it was natural that in their expansion, Japan already being in a sphere of influence would be a logical target. The Chinese forces landed in Japan during the first invasion, and they fought a brutal ground war against the Japanese. And the Japanese actually seemed to lose ground because of different styles of fighting. The Japanese samurai believed in one-on-one combat. The Chinese didn't. The Chinese just fought with masses of troops. And it was a major storm erupted, and it actually saved the Japanese because it sunk most of the Chinese fleet and forced the rest off the beaches and forced them to retreat. And so the Japanese believed they'd been divinely saved by the kamikaze, the divine wind. And this was even more cemented during the second invasion when the Chinese arrived with a massive armada. This time the Japanese had built a wall, a seawall, if you will, to prevent the Chinese from landing. So the Chinese fleet was sailing around to Japan to find an opportune location to land. They were struck by a typhoon, which sunk their fleet. Again, the divine wind. And this also helped create in the minds of the Japanese that their country was divinely ordained, because they believed that this was a sign from the gods. Shintoism, which is the state religion of Japan, is polytheistic, and they believed that the gods had saved Japan for some special purpose. But this did begin to build the mistrust and the animosity. And then under the Taiko, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, Japan attempted an invasion of Korea, where they were confronted by not just the Koreans, but by the Chinese as well. And of course, Korea always being in China's sphere of influence, this was seen as a direct threat to the Chinese. So there was this sort of back and forth, the Chinese harboring pirates that would attack Japanese shipping, up until the Sino-Japanese War, the first Sino-Japanese War.
And this is at the end of the 19th century, just after the Meiji Restoration.
Exactly. Japan decided it was its turn to grab some land in China, because at this stage now, China was weak, the Manchu dynasty was collapsing, and all the European powers were grabbing for land in China. In fact, even the United States had cantonments in China. The Germans, the French, the British, the Russians all had bits of land in China. So this began the idea that the Japanese wanted their piece of the imperial pie. So they began seizing land in Japan. But then truly during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, Japan seized all of Manchuria and began a full-blown occupation. But this wasn't just supposed to be a temporary occupation. They began shipping Japanese to Manchuria, giving them land so that they could colonize Manchuria. Japan had the eventual goal that it would not only dominate China, but it would eventually subvert China. It would eventually replace China, literally replace China. And we saw this in the 1930s with the rise of Japanese nationalism, the Marco Polo Bridge incident. Japan invades mainland China from Manchuria, and they begin a process of ethnic cleansing of the Chinese. And so this, again, you want to look at the origins of the animosity. You can see it beginning with the Sino-Japanese War, the Boxer Rebellion 1900, the seizure of Manchuria and the Russo-Japanese War, and then eventually culminating in the occupation of the Second Sino-Japanese War, where they began to march into mainland China. And you had the massacres in Shanghai, the rape of Nanking. And so these are things that cemented in the minds of particularly the Chinese a incredible hostility towards the Japanese, because the occupation of China was not a gentle one. It makes, and this sounds kind of crass to say it, but it's true, in terms of a level of horror, it almost makes the Nazi occupations of France sound gentle.
Of course, the Japanese Empire came to an end with its defeat by the United States in World War II. Is there any sentiment in Japan today to have an empire again?
Absolutely. And you're starting to see this rise in ultra-nationalism in Japan through the election of Shinzo Abe and his party, through support for the Nippon Kaigi, the ultra-nationalist society. You are starting to see this feeling in Japan, and a lot of it is born out of fear of China. The Chinese have a hostility towards the Japanese because of World War II. The Japanese have a hostility or a fear of China because of the fear that China might come one day to get its own back. And certainly a lot of the rhetoric coming out of China says that much. So that part of it's out of a necessity, a fear of China, fear of North Korea. And then part of it is because you have to remember that the warrior culture is so embedded in the Japanese society. You can't, no matter how you write it in the Constitution, no matter how much you try to indoctrinate the next generation, you cannot change thousands of years of culture and expect the Japanese to suddenly become pacifists.
And a point of dispute today is over islands in the China Sea called the Senkaku. Could you talk about the dispute over that?
Absolutely. There are a chain of islands south of Japan and largely uninhabited, although you could include in those islands the Ryukyu chain and, you know, islands like Okinawa and whatnot. But what the Chinese are laying claim to are the southernmost islands, which are uninhabited, but crucially lay around a lot of natural gas and oil. So, but for the Japanese, a lot of it's national pride as much as it is the practicality of natural resources. And the Chinese have seized several of those islands, including them in their quote-unquote air defense zone, which says that any aircraft flying into that area has to identify itself to the People's Liberation Army. And so the Chinese have effectively seized those islands. And for the Japanese, again, this emphasizes that, well, it's not much of a leap to go up the Ryukyu, up the Senkaku, and not stop in Okinawa, but continue up to mainland Japan. This is a logical fear for the Japanese, especially because China has decided that it will never again be subservient to the West or to the Japanese.
Of course, now the United States and Japan are kind of married to each other because of China's expansion into the South China Sea. Let me pose a hypothetical to you, Marshawn. Suppose there's an encounter in the South China Sea between the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy, and it escalates to a war. How would that, do you think that would play out in terms of what would Japan's response be? How would the United States deal with it? Are we talking about purely a naval war? Would there be any land component to it?
There would have to be a land component because Japan is far too close to China to not pose a threat. And in addition to South Korea. South Korea also is way too close to China. This would be something that would encompass a land war akin to what we experienced in World War II in the Pacific. The Chinese are very interesting when it comes to their military doctrine, where as Westerners, we may be a little rash. The Chinese are very calculating. They plan every move 1,000 years in advance. There's an old saying that dates back to the beginning of the first Chinese emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, in the 2nd century BC. And the saying goes, an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. And so the Chinese are very patient. They will wait. But when they decide to go to war, it'll be total and absolute. It'll encompass most likely a land conflict in Korea, a land conflict in Japan, and island hopping. If the Chinese were to seize Japan, they wouldn't need to seize the Philippines. They'd need to just push us out of Japan, push us out of the Wake Island, Guam, and Hawaii, and then they would ipso facto dominate the entire Pacific. We would cease at that point to be a Pacific power. So there would be a naval component, there would be an air component, and of course a huge land component. But without Japan, and particularly without Japan, without South Korea, there is very little that stands between the state of Hawaii and China's expansion.
Does Japan have a significant army that could defend the country today in the event that the Chinese army landed?
It depends, because there is a tremendous amount of military expansion going on in Japan. And certainly, as I said, for a country that is so insular, there is no way to know their true military capability. So, but just looking at it on the surface, taking at face value, the Japanese, they would only pose a threat in the sense that they would be difficult to occupy. And in that sense, they might slow the Chinese down enough that we would be able to mobilize. Because let's not forget, Japan is over 70% mountains. So it would be a nightmare to fight in Japan. As we had talked about with Afghanistan being a very, very difficult, nightmarish country to fight in because it is so mountainous, Japan would pose a similar problem. It has a lot of urban areas, but it has also a tremendous amount of mountains. It is over 70% mountains. So that would provide the Japanese army, even though it is probably less well-equipped than the Chinese army is, it would provide them much better ground to fight on, much better ground to stand on. And again, not knowing Japan's true capabilities, but just taking it at face value, it would more than likely stall the Chinese until we could mobilize our forces, hopefully. But we also have to remember that the Chinese engage in total war. Chinese warfare, if we take Tibet as the example, it is not just we will bomb your cities until you surrender. They fight wars of extermination. I mean, Tibet is now majority ethnic Han Chinese. It is not majority Tibetan anymore because they've exterminated huge aspects of the population. That's how the Chinese get compliance out of society. So it is really up in the air how long Japan would be able to hold out for to slow down the Chinese advance.
Marshawn, you had mentioned Korea. Would it be likely that the Chinese, in the event of a war between China and Japan and the United States, that the North Koreans, China's ally, would invade South Korea?
Absolutely. It would be an opportunity the Chinese couldn't afford to pass up, because especially if there's a war going on in Japan, if they're fighting us in Japan, if they're fighting us in other parts of the Pacific, and the North Koreans were to sweep across the border, it would be very difficult for us to respond to reinforce the South Koreans. The South Korean army is very, very tough. They are very tough soldiers, but it is a very small army. So the North Koreans probably could fight their way south. There are only 24,000 Americans, but without reinforcements, without the ability to resupply rapidly, it would be a way for the Chinese to push us out of Korea on the cheap. Let the North Koreans do the fighting and dying in Korea, and the Chinese can tie us down in other parts of the Pacific.
But to effectively stop the North Koreans or to help the Japanese resist a Chinese invasion, could you give me some idea of the number of American troops who would have to reach that area?
You have to look at the fact that the Chinese army as it stands, standing army, is approximately anywhere between 11 and 12 million soldiers. So that's a staggering number. Our technological capabilities are probably on par. The Chinese are very advanced technologically. What we can count on, though, is our leadership is more combat experience than theirs does. However, that's never necessarily been a handicap for the Chinese, as they just rely on sheer numbers of human beings to throw into the fight. So what it would require out of us in terms of our military capability is it would require the mobilization of our entire population. Again, something on par with World War II. We're not talking about a small brush fire war. We're talking about a major conflict. This would require us bolstering our armed forces to that of several million just to be able to stand against the Chinese. We also have to remember that their replenishment rate for their military, at least according to estimates in the CIA fact book, is approximately 20 million every year. That includes men and women.
So, I mean, if they drafted everybody, they could get 20 million new troops a year.
Exactly. So you're talking about a very heavy war of attrition. Again, our leadership has combat experience, whereas theirs does not. But at the end of the day, 24,000 American troops versus a million Chinese thrown into the fight, it would require us to bolster our military through staggering numbers. We also have to remember that unlike during World War II, we lack the industrial capacity. The Chinese have a huge industrial capacity. We don't have one anymore. Back during World War II, Henry Ford was manufacturing the Model T. War broke out, he started turning out Jeeps. Nowadays, we don't have manufacturing. All our cars are manufactured in China, India, and Mexico. So are the Chinese going to manufacture tanks for us while we're at war with them? I highly doubt it. It would take us a long time to reopen our old factories and begin manufacturing the stuff ourselves.
You know, Marshawn, I'm really wondering whether there would be a long war. We talked in the last show about China's new hypersonic glide vehicle, the DFCF, which is launched by an intermediate range ballistic missile. It goes just short of entering space and glides through the atmosphere at speeds of between 4,000 and 7,000 miles per hour. It's an extremely sophisticated guidance system. It could definitely cause some serious damage to our fleet. And I'm wondering if they were able to knock out our fleet in a relatively short time with this new missile, whether the war would actually last very long.
Well, that's also very true, too. I mean, we have to remember that this new missile would allow them to cripple our fleet in a very short order. And without a fleet, you cannot control the Pacific. You cannot maneuver in the Pacific. Let's also not forget, too, our fleet is aging. We have not been investing very thoroughly in our Navy, just the same way we haven't been investing in our Army or our Air Force at this stage. We're still flying B-52s that were developed during the Truman administration. In that sense, we'd be lagging. But also, let's not forget, the Chinese invested very heavily in submarines. And they view submarine warfare as the wave of the future, which might allow them, if they were able to get off the U.S. coast, to strike at our infrastructure at home. So they were not only able to sink our fleet, but also able to knock out parts of our electrical grid or our ability to command and control our forces. You're right, the war may end in very short order, because we would be too focused on trying to turn the lights back on at home, that it would be very hard for us to mobilize a force large enough to confront the Chinese in the Pacific. And that's something we do need to consider. If you were to have a Pearl Harbor scenario, this goes beyond just our Pacific fleet, but they have the ability to hit us at home.
This is a very dire scenario we're talking about. We're talking about it, though, because the conflict with China in the South China Sea or in Korea could escalate to a horrible war. And that's also why it seems to me that it's very important that we change our policy towards Russia, we get stability in Eastern Europe, and we induce Russia to look to the West and to end its alliance with China, so that we can focus our military efforts and our diplomatic efforts in the Pacific. And certainly, we should be thinking as creatively as possible about how we can get along with the Chinese, because a confrontation is something we don't want. As they prepare for war, but try all we can do to diplomatically prevent it from ever happening.
Absolutely. I mean, that takes the example of Prime Minister Eshkol from Israel, who did everything he could to prevent the outbreak of war with the Arabs up until he realized he had no choice but to give General Rabin the go-ahead to attack the Arab states. You have to, of course, exhaust every diplomatic avenue possible. But what we have to remember is China is expanding, and we may not be able to prevent their expansion. However, you're absolutely right. A relationship with the Russians is essential, because the Russians and the Chinese are not inherent allies. Russia now, it's a multi-ethnic state like we are. It is also a multi-religious one. It's a very diverse society. They are no longer a communist state. Authoritarian? Yes, I wouldn't want to live there. But we share much more common ground. Culturally, they are Westerners. Culturally, they are Europeans. Whereas on the other hand, the Chinese are an atheistic communist state. To be a member of the Communist Party, you have to disavow the existence of God. So you are looking at a country that is not an inherent ally of Russia. Russia's always sought to look west. So if we bring the Russians into the American sphere, it would allow us to put pressure on China. We also have to remember that this isn't just theory. The Russians and the Chinese fought each other during the Cold War, even though they were both communist. They had border battles, you know, with full Chinese and Russian tank brigades going at each other. So what this does, though, is this adds credence to the fact that China and Russia are not natural allies. Bring Russia into our sphere, China will be less likely to want a confrontation, because even though their military is very large, Russia's is very large. And at the end of the day, the Chinese, while they might be able to take on the United States individually, they could not take on the combined forces of the United States and Russia.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. You can download the War Report from our website, incontextreport.com, or from WPKN.org by clicking on Podcasts in the upper left-hand corner. The show is also archived at Radio for All. Watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.